The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, while the last few are getting their food, I'm just going to start us off with a couple of announcements, and then I'm going to turn it over to Daniela Kram and the Women in the Law program, who will also make a few announcements. So, events coming up this week and the next few weeks that the Center for Human Rights are hosting. One that I wanted to bring to your attention is tonight in this room, if not this room, then a room next door or the combined rooms, but in the lounge will be the Human Rights Happy Hour from 5 to 6 tonight. So I hope to see everyone there. If you have any questions, you can ask Ian Harris, who is actually here and raising his hands. Also, in October, we will be kicking off the 8th annual Human Rights Film Series, which will be held both at the law school and on the main campus. The first film in the series will be on Wednesday, October 3rd, starting at 6 o'clock in room 603. It's called Encounterpoint. Which is a fascinating story of two Israelis and two Palestinians as they risk their lives to promote nonviolence. So I encourage everyone to come out to that film showing. And if you can't make it to ours, please try to make it to the one on main campus. And finally, I also wanted to bring your attention to an event that we have coming up in November at the Katzen Arts Center Gallery. Called Torture Around the World. This is a panel discussion that will be done in conjunction with the Botero exhibit of the Abu Ghraib drawings. So it's going to be a very fascinating discussion and event, and I encourage everyone to come out on Thursday, November 15th at 5 p.m. to the Katzen Arts Center for that event. So at this point, I will turn it over to Daniela with the Women in the Law program.
Sorry, I had my mouth full earlier. I mean, food. Welcome, everyone. The Women in the Law in International Law program is extremely pleased to be co-hosting this event with the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law. We are very, very proud that the center, through their efforts, has brought Professor Khan here and made her a part of our intellectual and scholarly community, in large part because Professor Khan is not a lawyer. What does that mean, and why is that important, particularly to the Women in International Law program? It is important because until we understand really and truly how cultures operate, and by cultures I mean their religions, their communities, their societies, their art, and in particular, from Professor Khan's point of view, their literature, we will never actually understand the context in which human rights law is operating. We can talk all we want in abstract terms about universal declarations and about conventions and about treaties, but until we understand how people on the ground are thinking and behaving and acting from a sociological perspective, from an anthropological perspective, and from the perspective of arts and literature, we will never actually be able to truly engage. So I'm very, very pleased that Professor Khan is here bringing that perspective to this law school and her studies. And so with that, I'm going to turn things over to Hadar Harris, who will introduce Professor Khan, and I want to thank you all for being here.
It's a tag team, right? You thought, oh, we're never going to get to lunch. Oh, we're never going to actually get to the presentation. We are. I'm Hadar Harris. I'm the executive director of the Center for Human Rights and Humanitarian Law. We're pleased to see you all here. We're so glad that you're all such good friends that you pulled in extra chairs because you all want to sit at like two tables. But we're pleased to have you here. First, I want to thank Amelia Parker and Angie McCarthy, who work with the Center and with the Women and International Law Program, respectively, for setting up today's event and for all of the work of all of the Dean's Fellows who've done a great job in being photojournalists as well as logistics people and their help in setting things up today. Before I introduce Professor Han, I just want to also acknowledge how pleased we are that we have two representatives from the Department of State with us today who have been instrumental in making this partnership work, Ambassador Shirin Tahir Khili and Sasha Mira, who are with the Division of Women's Empowerment. Is that right? Am I going to get it right? I'm going to get it wrong. It's the Secretary's, the Secretary's Special Office of Women's Empowerment. And I was just about to say, Sasha is an alum of the law school herself. And so we're thrilled to have you both here to participate in the event today and appreciate your support of making this entire collaboration between WCL and the University of Peshawar possible. It's enriched all of us in ways that Daniela has already talked about, and we look forward to continuing this collaboration for the next few years with our fingers crossed. So thank you for coming up the hill for that. So now my job is to introduce Anush Khan. She is a professor in the Gender Studies Department at the University of Peshawar, the only Gender Studies Department in all of Pakistan, the first and only. She has been here with us at WCL twice before, once studying in the Academy on Human Rights and Humanitarian Law, and at the beginning of our collaboration last March when she came with several colleagues to check us out and see what this place was really going to be like. Now she's in residence with us for this semester as an international visiting scholar, and every time I speak with her, every time I have the opportunity to talk with her, I learn from her. And so it is my great privilege and my great honor to be able to introduce Professor Khan to talk about what it's like teaching gender and human rights in the Northwest Frontier Province of Pakistan. Thanks, Anush.
Ambassador Tahir Khili, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. And before I begin, I would like to thank Amelia to have the map here because I was trying to look for a map of Pakistan just to give you an orientation of at least where I hope that everybody knows where Pakistan is, but at least where Peshawar was. Okay. But anyhow, I would like to begin with a very brief introduction about Pakistan, NWFP, and Peshawar.
Move this down just so that you can see.
Okay. Pakistan gained independence on 14th August 1947 after a division of former British India. Geographically, I hope everybody can see, it is bounded by Iran in the west, Afghanistan in the northwest, India in the east and southeast, and Arabian Sea in the south. There's a common border with China alongside Gilgit and Baluchistan in the north. Pakistan is primarily divided into four provinces, which are, well, not very well seen here, but anyway, Pakistan is divided into four provinces, Balochistan, Northwest Frontier, the Punjab, and Sindh. The Islamabad Capital Territory and the federally administered tribal areas, commonly known as FATA and very much in news these days, and federally administered northern areas are in addition to the four provinces. Peshawar literally means city on the frontier in Persian and is known as Peshawar in Pashto. It is the provincial capital of Pakistan's Northwest Frontier province as well as the capital of the federally administered tribal areas. People belonging to the NWFP are predominantly Pashtuns or Pathans. Their language is Pashto. However, in today's world, Peshawar, for those who have heard the name, heralds many thoughts related to the Muslim and Pashtun identity, not only in the West, but within Pakistan itself. For those who are not familiar with Peshawar, a common notion even amongst Pakistanis, and I'm stressing even amongst Pakistanis, is that Pashtuns or Pathans are woodcutters, children abductors, women rights violators, in short, barbarians of a stone age living in some remote and rugged lands. As such, it's not a big shock if in the West, generally, people consider Pashtun men synonymous with Talibans and the women synonymous with the burqa or the veil and the parda, thus epitomizing religious and cultural radicalism. So I hope I have made my point clear because we do tend to have a variety of recognition in terms of what Pashtuns are even in Pakistan or the people primarily belonging to the frontier. However, that is not what Peshawar or NWFB is all about. Though there are things which may be easily said than done, like the establishing of the departments of gender studies and human rights being one, and the teaching of gender studies and human rights being another at the university. But at Peshawar University, we have proof that it is not a mission impossible. No matter whatever the media portrays about Pakistan in general and the NWFP in particular, we are still working there. And as a result, I am basically here. Let me give you a brief introduction about the Department of Gender Studies at the University of Peshawar. Being multidisciplinary in nature, various disciplines examine the ways in which distinctions of gender and socio-political inequalities are defined, interpreted, and discussed. Various conceptual frameworks are evaluated, and some of the contributions made by the gender studies to current scholarship in the humanities and social sciences assessed. Because of its very wide range and scope, the Department of Gender Studies draws its faculty from all the relevant departments of the university, as well as the national and international institutes and organizations. The major areas that we focus are academics, trainings, and research. Since the scope of gender studies is multidisciplinary and far-reaching, thus our mission is to mainstream gender studies in all faculties and disciplines of the University of Peshawar, eventually creating a human rights and a gender-sensitive society. The expected outcomes of the department, thus, are to produce human resources who are human right and gender sensitive, to promote the vision and mission of the department, and who can respond to the national and international commitments of the nation, that is, in accordance with the UDHR, CEDAW, MDGs, and so on. It is always very amazing to notice the various notions people have about the word gender. And in my talk, I had particularly written, particularly in NWFP, but since I'm sitting on a class with Daniela, we go through a lot of definitions of gender here as well. So I think it's usually the way it is universally defined. Some ponder if it means something different than sex. Others say it means women or women rights, being a feminist or advocating feminism. While some at the most believe it is a term showing the grammatical category of a word. In short, people ultimately regard gender synonymous with woman. I don't know how the things are here, perhaps Daniela or Hatara in a better position to tell, but that's how things are back in Pakistan. When you talk about gender, people think it has something to do with women, invariably. Well, in short, people ultimately regard gender synonymous with women. Whereas, very simply speaking, the term gender refers to the social and cultural roles assigned to men and women in society. Perhaps one can understand why people combine gender issues with women only. No doubt, gender includes both men and women, but I believe, but I believe that when it comes to an evaluation of sorts, women happen to be the poorest of the poor, the weakest of the weak, the most deprived of the deprived, and eventually the helpless of the helpless. However, the problem is that nowadays when we hear so much about human rights, why does the question of women's rights arise? Do women not form a part of the human rights framework and are thus not a part of the human rights campaign, or are they simply not worth it? So now I will just like to talk a little about the social importance of the gender perspective within human rights with particular reference to the NWFP. While trying to integrate and teach gender and human rights in NWFP, particularly Peshawar, I will talk about three aspects in particular. That is the practical legal field, both the formal and the informal sectors, the actual teaching at the university level, and imparting gender and human rights sensitization trainings to various organizations, both government and non-government. In the practical field, the formal legal practices are seen both inside and outside the courts. Here I'm not talking about the litigation processes or the decision issues because that's a totally different debate, but the general atmosphere of the law courts, the number of female lawyers and judges, and of course the female plaintiffs and their female supporters. The general atmosphere of the courts is not gender friendly at all. Even today, a woman in the frontier province or perhaps in Pakistan is very hesitant to go to the courts. It is generally believed that the ratio of female lawyers and judges is on the increase, but it is not at all par with the male ratio, not to speak of the senior positions. Here I would like to quote some relatively latest statistics that I downloaded recently, and I quote. On the home front, the gender parity dictum is mortifyingly hollow to merit any comparison. From the time of appointment of the first Chief Justice of Pakistan, Justice Sir Abdur Rashid, to the active Chief Justice Rana Bhagwan Das, and perhaps this quotation is of the times when we were having the recent problem of the Supreme Court Chief Justice, because Rana Bhagwan Das was then the acting Chief Justice. Pakistan has had 22 Chief Justices of the Supreme Court, and not one of them has been a woman. When confronted with the negligible number of women in the judiciary, one can hardly take seriously the oft-repeated strain of the government that it has inducted a historic number of women in the local government and parliament. Statistics taken from the provincial bar councils indicate that Pakistan has a total of 45,000 licensed legal practitioners. Sindh follows with 14,000, the NWFP has 3,000, and the province of Balochistan rates the lowest with only 1,772. Despite this number, only 5 women since the country's independence have made it to the superior court's benches. Lack of judicial diversity is evident in the present composition of the superior judiciary. The 17-judge Supreme Court of Pakistan, including the acting Chief Justice, has no female judge on its bench. The Lahore High Court, Lahore is the provincial capital of the province Punjab. The Lahore High Court has 35 sitting judges, but not one of them is a woman. The same applies to Balochistan and the Peshawar High Courts. The former has 5 judges and the latter 14, without a single woman sitting as a judge. An exception to the Superior Court's all-male composition is the Sindh High Court, which has inducted 2 women, Ms. Yasmin Abbasi and Ms. Kaiser Iqbal, and it was not until August 1994 that 5 female judges were promoted to superior courts. Justices Fakhrunnisa and Nasra Iqbal were from the Punjab. Talat Yaqub and Khalda Rashid Khan were appointed as judges of Peshawar High Court, while Justice Majida Rizvi became the first woman in Sindh to sit in Karachi's High Court. Except for Khalda Khan, and this article I downloaded, this article dates somewhere in April 2007. So perhaps statistics are a little changed now, but that was the latest I could find. Except for Khalda Khan, who's currently serving as a permanent judge of the United Nations Tribunal, the rest retired without being promoted to the rank of Chief Justice. And her tenure came to an end in May 2007. The present government's provinces of gender diversity were challenged when the ruling Supreme Court said that the most senior judge in the High Court and Supreme Court has a legitimate right to become the Chief Justice of the respective court. In 2002, Justice Fakhrunnisa had become the senior most judge of the Lahore High Court and should have been rightfully made the Chief Justice, but her position was filled by a male judge. Justice Fakhrunnisa accused the government of gender bias and criticized it for taking 7 months to fill the Supreme Court vacancies, which should have been filled within 30 days to prevent her entry into the most superior judiciary bench of the country. And I unquote. Besides not being gender sensitized, the lawyers and judges do not undergo any kind of a formal training in human rights, neither during academic nor their professional careers. And along with the formal law courts in the frontier province, particularly in the tribal belt, there is another traditional and rather informal legal system that runs parallel with the formal courts called the jirga system. The jirga, or the jury, primarily consists of the village local elders or people of influence, for example, the landlord there. The jirga system, I believe, predates the colonial rule. The reason that the jirga system still exists is that it is much more accessible and affordable in terms of time, distance, and finances compared to the formal law courts. The jirga decisions most of the times, I presume, have a human rights perspective, but can't say that they have a gender perspective. No women are a part of the jirga, by the way. However, the government has come up with yet another parallel program called Gender Justice through Masalati Anjuman, and Masalati Anjuman means a reconciliatory council. Ironically, these reconciliatory councils are created to do away with the jirga, because they believe that jirga decisions are extremely binding and at times tend to be unjustly authoritative and gender biased in some cases. So perhaps that says a little about the human rights dimension as well. To add to the irony, these reconciliatory bodies ideally should comprise of two men and one woman. Again, from within the locality, and in some cases, if they can't find a woman, the council consists of all men. So I hope you're able to see what kind of a parallel is coming out of the jirga and the reconciliatory councils that they're trying to have. So this is just a very, very brief overview of the legal paradigms. Now, coming to the teaching and curriculum development, particularly at the university level, because that's where I'm personally involved. Surprisingly, the University of Peshawar is the only university in entire Pakistan to have the first and only departments of gender studies and human rights. I will focus more on the Department of Gender Studies, as I obviously have a hands-on knowledge about the department. Apart from the bureaucratic hurdles, which I believe are same everywhere in all universities, the first and the foremost problem in establishing the department was the space. And we as a department have shifted premises thrice. And only yesterday, I got an email from my colleague that the new vice chancellor, the vice chancellor is the president of the university, the new vice chancellor wants us to shift our department elsewhere because the current premises is required for another project. This is a whole department with students, with research, with trainings, with an entire schedule for almost a year going on, which includes informing so many people about different activities, let alone the students. On a more serious note, the course development was a very, very serious concern, as we do not have gender specialists. The faculty that we have has had various trainings in gender workshops, but not really dealing with course development. The faculty does not have formal academic degrees in gender studies, but being an area of interest and research in respective discipline helps in teaching at the department. Therefore, we requested certain people from within the university for help, while reached out to others both nationally and internationally for developing our courses. As such, we have only four permanent faculty members who are both teaching and doing the administrative jobs. We have about 10 to 12 visiting faculty on whom we are greatly dependent. And we almost become non-functional if we don't have the visiting faculty. The next challenging area pertaining to particularly gender studies and human rights is the student enrollment. Most of the students opt for gender studies because they don't know what they're really opting for. I mean, that's what we find out later down the year. Or when we have the interviews with them, the initial interviews, just to see who's coming in, that's what we discover. They come to the department because they have heard that gender is an in thing, or a friend or a parent suggested it, or simply because they didn't get admission anywhere else. So, you know, this is a department which is new and is going to take anybody and everybody that's come, although that's not the situation, though. The problem with teaching gender studies in our culture is that it is misunderstood as a Western term, propagating some Western ideology. And secondly, gender inevitably, due to lack of knowledge, is understood to be some discipline which teaches women rights and in turn produces radicals, ready to topsy-turvy the entire cultural and moral system. It was quite an exercise. I mean, this is just a little anecdote that, I mean, for those, since I see a lot of people perhaps coming from Southeast Asia, it was quite an exercise when we had to translate the name of the department into Urdu, the local language, because we had to do it. We began off with an shoba in Urdu, the national language, means discipline. We began off with shoba in Aswaniya. It seems a big word even in Urdu, but that was equivalent to Department of Women's Studies. Then we turned off and we thought of Shobhaye Jinsiyat, which would radically translate into Department of Sexuality Studies, which we just could not afford naming the department. Very frankly speaking. Finally, we hit upon Shobhaye Sinfiyat, which is the exact translation for the Department of Gender Studies. But the process was not so easy. We had to pull in people from the Urdu department, from the Arabic, Islamiyat department to be like, not just correct language or linguistically, but to be politically correct as well, because that does play a very big role. Another major problem that I see regarding student enrollment in gender studies and human rights is that neither gender studies nor human rights is offered at the undergraduate level in our university or at any other university in Pakistan. So obviously, students have no orientation of what these disciplines are all about, and therefore are very skeptical in doing their masters in that. And thus coming back to the idea that just because they didn't get admission anywhere, or just because they don't know what gender studies is, or just because some UN project requires gender specialists and analysts, so you know they might as well do gender studies to fulfill certain job requirements. Another gender and human, I'm sorry, because of all the lovely introductions that I had for myself and the way Daniela and Hadar just began off, I don't have a very colorful picture to show here of what we are doing with gender studies and human rights. Teaching gender and human rights as part of gender studies has its own challenges, because we do offer a paper, which is a paper on gender and human rights, but then that in itself has its problem. The biggest problem is that we do not have specialists in the field of gender and human rights. As in our case, we have a visiting faculty who is excellent at teaching human rights, but he does not have a gender perspective. And so we had to hire another faculty who was a lawyer basically, but had a human rights perspective, so she could integrate gender and human rights together. Our worst nightmare is when both of them can't turn up for the classes because they are visiting. Now, why can't we turn to the human rights center or the department that we have is for like a permanent help and a permanent solution to this problem is because it only has one faculty member who is a full-time faculty member at the law school as well. So I hope I'm being able to, you know, give you the idea of like why it, in terms not culturally, but how academically and logistically teaching gender and human rights is not such an easy job. As I mentioned earlier, apart from teaching gender and human rights at the university, we also impart human rights and gender sensitization trainings to government and non-government organizations. For example, we trained the master trainers for the gender justice through Masalati Anjuman project. Now, since we are already short on faculty, the work for these sorts of trainings add to the already existing responsibilities. For such trainings, we have to compile the trainer and the trainee manuals with appendices and PowerPoint presentations, and most of the times, all these training materials have to be translated into either the national or the local languages, which again makes us dependent on yet another department. Besides, the trainees for these various trainings are from various academic and professional backgrounds, so some of them have completely no knowledge of what gender and human rights is all about. Therefore, they are not really serious and are only taking the training to make their resumes more colorful, or either it's a job requirement. Besides, with some of them, it's extremely difficult to wipe out a lifelong socialization of societal and cultural roles. Even if we have a 5 days training, they're not ready to believe what we are training them. On top of that, when there are women, and by the way, it's an all-women's department, so on top of that, when there are all women imparting the training, particularly to men, who usually come from very traditional and conservative backgrounds, there are all the more reasons to take such a training non-seriously and leisurely. Because they just believe that, please, I would like you to imagine for a while that frontier happens to be still a very, very traditional area, even in Pakistan. And we have all these people coming from various government departments as well as the NGOs. It is so difficult to change the mindset. Not only that, just as when they see that a woman is coming to train, oh, you know, there's this thing that, what is she going to teach us? And it was very interesting because I did ask some of my students, I told them that I kind of peek at you people. When there's a man in the class, you people are more serious. And when there's a woman, you tend to take liberties. Somebody's looking here and there. Somebody's looking outside. And they said, no, we don't do. We take your class so seriously. I said, no, I've been observing you. You see, it's a gender studies department. And they promised, they said, no, we are as serious in even the female classes. And I said, okay. So one day I just kind of walked into one of the classes that was being taught by senior faculty as well. And all of them were quiet. Some were standing out because they were late and they were not allowed to the class. And in our classes, they are just coming and going. And so, you know, I asked the two of them, I said, why are you standing out? They said, because we are late and he's not letting us in. And I said, well, in my class, you know, for even if you are 10 minutes late, you just want to kind of all peek inside and kind of have these requesting looks to let you in. So why don't you do the same thing with him? And they said, no, we can't do it with him. I said, see, so I had a point when I told you that you people take those classes more seriously. So, and you can imagine these are students who still to an extent have a certain relationship, certain dynamics with us. But when we come to teaching strangers, men, it becomes at times you really have to control yourself during those teaching, during those trainings, because they would come up with a remark or with some kind of a gesture that if you don't kind of avoid, the entire training or the entire program has to come to a standstill then. Anyway, but we are managing. And above all, whether teaching at the master's level or imparting a gender or human rights sensitization training, it is pertinent to include a course or a module on religion. And by that, I of course mean Islam. Please bear in mind that gender and human rights are believed to be Western ideologies. So there has to be a perspective of Islam that kind of validates that how much these ideas are there in Islam as well. The socio-politically turbulent times that we are going through, nothing can be taught without a religious dimension and religious authentication, particularly when it comes to matters like women rights, birth control issues, marriage rights and obligation, inheritance, evidence, you name it, which notably are both human rights as well as gender issues. So, thus the reason for my being at the American University is, of course, to meet people like you and to strengthen the academic side of gender and human rights departments at the University of Peshawar. And the experience gained at AU will hopefully serve as a springboard for me and my colleagues to contribute positively and substantially to the cause of gender equity and equality and the sincere achievement of human rights at large. And I hope that I've been able to give you some insight into teaching gender and human rights in NWFP Pakistan. And finally, in addition to their tireless and unconditional facilitation, I would like to take this opportunity to thank Hadar Harris, Amelia Parker, Daniela Crime, and Angie McCarthy for making this event possible and giving me a chance to talk to all of you, and of course, the U.S. Department of State. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Yeah.
If anybody has questions, I know some people have to rush off to class either to learn or to teach or to do both at the same time. But if people have questions, if you can identify yourself and ask your question loudly since we are recording.
My name is Ann Goldstein. I'm with the International Association of Women Judges, and I have a question about your last point. And forgive me, I was late, so by rights I should have stood out. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
But I'm working through a manual put together by Indonesian Muslim women's rights activists that makes an argument for women's rights based on a concept I'm probably mispronouncing, but it is Tawhid, T-A-W-H-I-D,
yes.
That the argument is that any rule one group to arrogate to itself power not allowed to another group, and therefore violate the most. You see where I'm going?
Yes, yes.
And I have been asking people from different countries their reaction to this, if it's too radical. This comes up in work I do, training judges. I'm just wondering what you think the response might be to that.
To be very frank, I hope I am able to answer your question to a certain extent, because I'm neither a lawyer nor a religious scholar for that matter. But what I have learned out of our own experiences, particularly at the Department of Gender Studies, I think a lot has to do with the cultural interpretation of things as well. Because since Tawheed is a concept, which is the basic concept in Islam, and it does, I mean, if you are a believer of Tawheed, of course you have to abide by what the basic human rights are there in Islam. But what you're talking about, I mean, this does not just kind of, I know the argument can be based taking the foundation of Islam, but I don't know if Indonesia is even a signatory to CEDAW and all these treaties. Why are they having, I'm not saying that this does not happen in Pakistan, but at the same time, it all depends on who is kind of looking at laws and treaties and even religious laws or Islamic jurisprudence as it may be, and how they are interpreting it. There can be a very radical view to it. There can be a very progressive view to it. I mean, had that been the case, radically speaking, I wouldn't be standing here.
I guess the question I'm trying to pose, perhaps inartfully, is how useful an argument do you find that argument?
If, like, you're asking for my personal opinion, I think that this argument, of course, I mean, Islam says that there has to be no difference with certain reservations in certain areas on the basis of sex, and wherever those reservations are, for example, in the act of evidence, it does have certain reasons to back that up. But I don't know what the stance of a person who's more radically inclined towards religion might be, if I have, answered your question, what you were looking for. My personal stance would be very progressive, depending on what the situation is. Well, okay. Now, since you're asking about the students, it was very interesting when we advertised, since this is our very first batch of the masters that is going to graduate somewhere in October or November. When we advertised that for the admissions, we had kept a certain number of seats for male students because we were anticipating that, you know, men are not going to come, thinking that it's all a women thing. And we had around more than 200 applications. I don't exactly remember the figure, but we were alarmed at the figure. And because, I mean, we were anticipating, nobody knows what gender is all about. So, you know, where are all these applications coming from? And we kind of downsized it to about 51. And we were, the university just gave us 25 seats. And we did not even ask for more because we didn't just want to produce people having a master's in gender studies and not knowing what to do with it, adding to the already unemployment rate that is there. So we were happy with whatever the university gave us. And alarmingly, most of them were men. And finally, when we got our students in, because there's a small entry test that we have and then there's a small interview, we had a class of about, we have a class of about 17, and out of them, 12 are boys and 5 are girls. And later on, I mean, yet they do have certain plans in mind because now I don't know how they are going to really fare into it, because gender is still a very in issue in Pakistan, because since we are a signatory to CEDAW and to a few other things, not that we are really abiding by it, but we are a signatory. So there are a lot of international organizations that are doing projects, and ultimately, particularly in the frontier, all of them want to have a gender perspective to it. So therefore, students have certain things in mind what they are going to do. But one of the most encouraging things for us is that since we are not really getting the students who are looking for doing a master's in gender studies, most of the students come from very, very far-flung areas, coming from the north. I don't know if you can see it from here. Dir and Chitral, and these are not only far-flung, but very backward traditional areas, very culturally oriented. And there are, of course, who until the end of the session are, you know, a little skeptical of what we have done to them. But at least it makes them thinking. You see, even if you make somebody skeptical, it means that at least they are thinking. So, I mean, I would look at it that way. So, but then we would see that one or two students, and I'm particularly talking about males, because males have a big role to play in our society still. But one or two of the students out of a class of 17 have come and like talked to us that how their perceptions about things are changing, though it may be very difficult to integrate those perceptions into their family all of a sudden, but they have started thinking about things and they have started looking at things in a different way. So for us, out of a class of 17, even if two people have their perspectives change, it is a big achievement, because you kind of have to be in a place to culturally understand how the people are oriented there. So I in no way represent Frontier typically. Otherwise, I wouldn't be really standing here. I hope I do represent Pakistan, but the idea that is prevalent in Frontier, it's not that you don't see women on the streets. You do. There are a lot of working women. There are a lot of women who are out on the streets. But the general perception still is that, you know, woman has to stay indoors.
I actually have a question about the courses themselves and what the course materials are, because I would imagine that a lot of people here have taken gender studies courses in American universities across the United States. And, you know, when I think of the books that we read and the things that we talked about, I don't see it being the same materials that necessarily that you're covering in there, both from the language standpoint and also from starting point. You know, you're dealing with a different starting point of where your students are. So I was just wondering if you could elaborate.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, in the sense that when it comes to language, we don't really have a choice.
Right.
We are a multilingual society,
right.
But the medium of instruction in the university is English. So at the end of the day, the students have to take an exam in English. So what we can do at the most to facilitate the students is to kind of sometimes translate things. But if you just keep on translating, how are they going to eventually learn to express themselves in English? And then, not that everybody is so fluent, but English happens to be the official language. So it is taught at school right on as they go to school. So they may not be very proficient, but they have a little inkling of English, and they may not be as expressive or as fluent, but at the end of the day, they have to take the exam in English. That makes me just a little problem that we have, like all the women gender studies books that we have been getting from abroad, because or getting them from Pakistan, one thing that I've noticed, the language is very difficult. And I went to, one of the women studies classes on the main campus, and I kind of inquired from the students there, keeping in mind that English is the first language here, and it's, you know, the mother tongue for the most. I said, how do you find the language? Like when we are talking about all these different theories and philosophical ideologies, how do you find the language? And they said, we find the language difficult. So you see, if students here tend to find the language difficult, I mean, I have my sympathies for my students. Now, when it comes to, just as I said in my talk, we never really had a formal guideline. So what we did was that we did go on to international websites, as you said. We visited a few American university websites, and we visited a few websites in UK, and we just kind of tried to see, like, what are they teaching? And then we just couldn't teach what they were exactly teaching, because we had to be more culturally and contextually oriented. Primarily, we still follow the annual system, which is like you take an exam at the end of the year, unlike a semester system. And therefore, in the first year, we have all the core courses. I presume you have been a student of women's studies. So all the core courses, which include like feminist movements and feminist theories and research methodology and things like that. But we have to have a paper on gender and religion. The paper is gender and religion. Because we try to give them an overview of what world religions say, like beginning from Greek mythology and Roman mythology, and finally coming down to all the organized religion with a focus on Islam. Because we have to kind of start on the right foot. Since when I start talking to them about, you know, Marxist theories, or when I start talking to them about radical feminism, I mean, you can imagine, they have serious doubts about me, and in I teach them. I'm telling you what the situation is like. I personally teach feminist theories in the first year. And invariably, towards the end of the session, I am asked, invariably, I mean, there are two sessions that we have had, I'm asked, which school of feminism do you kind of, you know, associate yourself with? And my usual answer to the students is that, why don't you make a guess? Because generally, when you talk about feminism, everybody thinks it's radical.
That question is very common in American universities.
Exactly. Right. I'm just getting an idea, and I'm just coming to the fact that, you know, things are not very different. I mean, the kind of idea that I had there. Now, coming to the materials, since we have a big reading list, and we do have access to a lot of books, like thanks to the links that we have here, I will probably be ordering books for the library. Then we do have other resources. Then the university has its own resources where we can get books from. The problem was that when I taught them the first year, I thought, because since it's not their first language, it's a new discipline, they needed more than books. So this year, since it was an experiential experience for me as well, this year I compiled a compendium myself, taking from, you know, different resources, so at least they have the guidelines of what they had to follow, and of course keeping the language in mind. Now, you can't go to a simpler level than what is there in the books, but slightly what I thought they would be able to understand. And with that, I would make PowerPoint presentations just to get the main ideas, because unfortunately we don't function so systematically well in Pakistan that I give the students a reading and they will do it. They don't usually. Daniela had a sigh. So you know, I mean, I just can't wait that they do the reading and we kind of go on, because we have to move on. So I compiled the compendium, and I would have the main points on a PowerPoint. And then that would also tell me, like, who's really studied and who's serious and not. That's one way. And in the second year, things start becoming a little more specialized, and that is where we actually face the problem. We are offering a course on gender and development, gender and human rights, gender and literature. And gender and literature tends to have three components. I'm personally teaching them gender and literature in English. And for which, again, we compiled the course ourselves, because we had to keep in mind that these were not literature students. So it did not have to be what the students at the master's level were doing in literature. It just had to make them understand that how a text can be gender biased. So for that, there had to be a simpler text. And then we are teaching them gender and literature in Urdu, which is the national language. And then we are also teaching them gender and literature in Pashto, which is the local language. So just to, again, kind of give them that idea that gender is not a Western concept. It is not to be seen in Western literature. This concept and these concepts are very prevalent in your national as well as your local literature. Then we have, and we are teaching them a course on on feminist research methodology as well. But that comes in the second year, although they just learn to research in the feminist way, but they don't really research, because the university doesn't accept that research. University accepts the general social sciences pattern of researching. And then the students have a choice. We give, I mean, depending again on the availability of the faculty, that we give them a pool of subjects, which are gender and social policy, gender and psychology, gender and media. A lot of students opt for that. And gender and IT, science and technology. So depending on the availability of the faculty, the students have to, depending on what we have decided, the students have to make a choice from a pool of these subjects as well. Have I answered your question?
Yes.
And which university are you talking about?
University.
Okay.
That's French language. It's not actually
the French. It's the South, yeah.
Yeah, it's okay. The South, which is it's very conservative.
Very conservative, very traditional.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They weren't ready to kind of discuss ideas, and so this was her experience, my friend's experience.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, when they arrive at your class, and that's the thing, usually we come in to a gender studies class here, and we have this kind of idea, oh, let's get into this. Let's,
right.
Like, figure this out. And I'm wondering how your students put the kind of mentality that...
You see, like, most of the students in our department complain that we are just trying to, you know, go off the stream. That is not how departments are generally functioning in the university, for which we don't really hear what they are saying, because we have to function the way we have to function. That's a part of being the gender studies department, you know. So what we had in mind is that we usually, once a week, we have tutorial classes, and we pay, and tutorial are just discussion classes with no particular agenda. So you would just begin off by telling them that, okay, and we divide the students in small groups. That is just to give them an orientation of how discussions are to take place. Because just like your friend said, we don't have a way of teaching where discussions or very open discussions are really encouraged, unless you get to the university level, you see, and then too, depending on the teacher. And since we are in the annual system, not following the semester, some departments are. So a point comes when you're really pressed on time and you have to finish the course. So that is the time, by that time, we hope that the students have gotten in click. So one of the objects of that, those tutorial classes are, we begin off by just telling them, you know, pick up a news item, what are your interests? We have a general informal introduction with each other. We talk about interest just to get them going, actually, just to know each other. Because please bear in mind that even if you're talking about Pondicherry, these are societies where men and women don't socialize together. So you have to kind of break that ice between the students, amongst the students as well. And you have to make a class that is gender balanced. You see? So, like, gender invariably plays in many different ways in the way we are teaching, without really us being very conscious to it as well. And that's how we get them moving. And ultimately, since we have to teach our part, because one of the reasons that why students are not so much into the discussion is because of the language. There are a lot of materials that they do need help. And I've realized that I've been teaching for quite some time. I've been teaching literature to students. But one of the positive part of teaching literature was that they were those students who already knew how to speak English. So, you know, I wouldn't find, although I was teaching them functional English as well, because English is the second language in Pakistan and it has to be taught until the undergrad level. And, of course, the dynamics of the students there would be very different, but then the course would be very different as well. So when I came to the gender studies department, I realized that it can't be just an all English class because, you know, one, the concepts are new and radical. Secondly, students come from diverse backgrounds. And none of them really, I mean, none of them come from English-speaking families. So that is why you see students, you have to kind of get them into the discussion mode, and a lot depends on the teacher as well, because the teacher is kind of double burdened. She has to or he has to finish the course, depending if you are, even if you are in a semester, because you just can't follow the pattern that is followed in the American universities, since language being the biggest hurdle, right? And so you just try to gain their confidence. Now, that I believe varies from class to class and the group to, sometimes you have a group which is very vocal and you have to kind of, you know, hush them all the time to get your point through, all right? And I hope that was not a suggestive one. I'm sitting on one of Daniela's class, actually, you
and
see.
Very vocal.
So, you know, and sometimes you have a class that just wouldn't talk. So it depends a bit on the group dynamics, but I still believe it depends a lot on the teacher as well, how to kind of, you know, get them moving.
Have you made any attempt to translate your material?
Oh, yes.
I'm thinking specifically from materials on the human rights, the local basis, the indigenous basis of human rights norms, the Urdu and Pashto,
well,
English.
The council that I was talking to you about that we had trained, our basic task, because this was a government project, of course funded by various international organizations, and I think this is something I should tell you. It was basically the government, since we have a federal government, but we have our own provincial governments as well. And every province was responsible for making its own manual and kind of, you know, telling how they are going to train the trainers. And in Peshawar, we had two NGOs, and it was us that we teamed to, like the three of us teamed together, and we were responsible for the manual. Our part, because we were from the academics, we had to compile the manual and make all the materials. And the duty of the NGOs was to actually go into the field and then impart the trainings. We just had to train the master trainers. And when we went to Islamabad, because we had to make a presentation there in the rural ministry of what we were doing and what we were planning to do, and all of the provinces, all of the provinces came up with whatever they had to do or how they thought they were about to go. And I don't know how things function in the States, but, you know, we tend to have our own prejudices everywhere. And so when they said, oh, they are from Peshawar, and everybody kind of looked and say, okay, let's see what they have to talk about, gender justice. So when we made our presentation, there were a lot of things that the respective secretary didn't really approve of, but he said, well, you should change this, you should change that, and we said, okay. And finally, when the meeting, it was a three-day meeting that we had, and finally when the meeting was over and we were just wanting to rush back home, the secretary responsible for that ministry, he told us that we believe that why don't you make the entire manual for Pakistan? Now, that was a big honor for us, but keeping in mind we are four faculty members taking full-time classes, we couldn't say no, because that was a feather in our cap, so we couldn't say no to that. We agreed with all high eyebrows from other people, like, you know, who had been kind of looking down upon us. We did that, and when we had finished doing it, and we thought we are through, and we were, thank God, we never made copies. We get a call from Islamabad that please translate the manual into Urdu. And now the problem is that, I mean, since you start working in one language, your mind starts working in that language, if you understand what I mean. And when it comes to translating technical terms, you need a technical translator. I mean, perhaps I can just give you the gist of what something means, but technical translation is difficult. So we just sat down and thought, who's going to, like, you know, translate everything, the slides, the manuals, whatever went in with that. And finally, we had to call in people from the Urdu department. And now the problem was, they didn't know the technical definitions. Like I just told you how difficult it was for us to translate the department's name. But of course, we are doing that depending on the opportunities we get and the time that we have. But what you are saying is being done by most of the NGOs there. Translation into English, I think that they are primarily focusing more on the local things. You see, because our problem at the moment is we have a lot of resources in English. We don't have access to them in Urdu or the local, the regional languages. So if academically there's a lot of translation going on into English from regional and local. But as far as NGOs are, I don't think so, because that's not the requirement at the moment. The requirement is the other way around. Well, by the time, like, when I'm, like, teaching them theories, they haven't really developed that critical idea. But you know something? What really interests them, and I'm just surprised, is the psychoanalytical theory. I remember the first time I had to teach it, I was a little skeptical because, you see, we are still a very close society, and I had this room full of boys. And I went to one of my professors. You see, the problem is not that I can't teach them. The problem is they looking at me and kind of, you know, trying to get meanings out of that. I mean, you have to understand that gender dynamics which works in a society, you know. So I went to my professor and I asked him, I said, how do you teach psychoanalytical theory to the class? And he said, well, you teach the way you teach. I said, no, of course I understand that, but, like, how do I go about it in the class, you know? He said, see, either you teach or you don't teach. There is no one or two way about it. So you just go to the class and you teach. I said, okay. So I just went to the class, but I had to give them a small briefing. Because, see, these the things that we are talking about in gender studies is not usually what people are talking about in Pakistan. And that's why, like, sometimes you do tend to have a lot of criticism coming from within the university, because, of course, the students go and discuss outside. And so, you know, people start wondering, what are you teaching them? and what is going on there. Like initially one of the students came and he said that, can I record your lecture? And I said, yes, please do, or whatever happens in the class. He said, because let me tell you honestly, my friends in the hostel or the residents, they want to know, what are we talking about in the class? I said, oh, of course, go on. And but luckily, it was one of those classes which was not very controversial, so, you know, which would have sounded controversial to them. And so that was one theory in my personal experience. And when I'm teaching them, like, I'm talking from my personal experience, whatever I am teaching them. And when it comes to gender and literature, of course, there are these short, very contemporary poets that I take, and not like Shakespeare or somebody, because, you know, I can't get into the nuances of the language and trying to translate that and all. So that does at times make them think. Radical theory, they definitely don't believe in.
I'm going to take the prerogative of the last question, the first and the last, to ask you. You painted a very challenging landscape, and I'm sure that among the things I know from our conversations, in addition to everything that you painted, there's so much more that you're confronted by in terms of doing this work. Where are the glimmers of hope? Leave us with
the positive. Okay. Well, I see this link definitely as a glimmer of a big ray of hope, not just a glimmer.
And it's not just because the ambassador.
No. It's not. No, it's not because of that. The reason being, because, I mean, looking at it, not just traditionally in the cultural sense, but even academically, we are a very traditional university still. Like, we are not very open to new ideas. Somebody does have some kind of a point to make. One of the ways why I said this link is because having a degree from abroad, no matter whatever you are doing or whatever you have done there, but just having a degree from abroad, which I believe is not very easy to get anyway, that really strengthens you. Because it gives you that hierarchical pedestal, you see, both materially, when it comes to your position, your different university positions at the different levels, and even within the students as well. And I really hope that, you know, sometimes I tell them, like one of my students, he said, oh, you're going to the States again. I said, yes, I wish that all of you do end up going to the States, because things are not the way that we think that they are. I mean, the media has a lot of role to do in that. So I believe that from programs like these, there is a lot, because one, of course, I do develop and mature individually, but at the same time, I know it is not like practically possible to get all those students here. So what I take back to them as my personal experience, that gives us hope. And secondly, when we function in the university itself, you see, that does make a difference, because after going back from here, I mean, you're not just talking, you are talking sense. And there are such first-hand-on experiences. And besides, just although we are uprooted again, I believe, but just staying there in itself is a ray of hope too. And for that, like, you have to have people who genuinely believe in what they are doing. Because I personally believe, I mean, if you are not gender-sensitized yourself, if you are not human rights-sensitized yourself, you can never fight for the cause. Because that has to come, something has to come from within, you know. It's not just that it has to look good on your resume and you have to be in. That's what I keep on telling the students. I mean, you can only be passionate and hopeful about things if you are true to yourself.
Thank you. I guess I can't quite slip through there like I thought I could. I want to thank Professor Han for her very interesting lecture, but not just for that, really for all of the work that she does against tremendous challenges, some of which you've heard about, many of which you haven't heard about, because she's being very polite and diplomatic. And this was polite and diplomatic. So I want to thank you both for the work that you do and the way that you are able to inspire not just your students at home, but us as an intellectual community and a community of colleagues here. I also want to thank all of you for coming, students, staff, faculty, and outside guests for joining us today. And hope that you will take advantage of the fact that Anush will be here at least through this semester and hopefully doing her PhD studies on the main campus starting in January. And so she will be an accessible resource to all of us over the coming months, and we look forward to continuing our relationship both with her and with the University of Peshawar over the long term. So thank you all for coming. Have a good day.